Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us linguist Emily Menon Bender, professor of linguistics and adjunct professor of computer science at the University of Washington, where she has been a member of the faculty since 2003. She studied at UC Berkeley with an AB in linguistics, Tohoku University in Sendai, Japan, where she was a visiting scholar, and Stanford University, where she received an MA and PhD in linguistics. She is the author or co-author of 3 books and over 90 articles on various topics in linguistics, including 2 articles in Writing It Real, an online publication for those who write from personal experience. Emily is the mom of 2 boys, Toby 14 and Rafe 11, who previously appeared on this show in the spring of 2016. In her spare time, she enjoys travel, photography, and learning new languages. In the spirit of full disclosure, I should say that Emily Menon Bender is my daughter. Welcome, Emily.
Thanks, Mom. It's great to be here.
It is exciting for me to interview you in a program about writing and the writer's life. And so I might as well start with this question. Do you think having had a poet for a mom influenced your choice of career?
Looking back, I certainly see a connection. So I've long thought of linguistics as something that brings together interest in language and interest in math. And so I've always said of myself that I got science from dad and language from you, and so of course it makes sense to be a linguist.
Oh, well, of course, to some of us. Now, you might remember that I thought you should become an engineer. So I recognized your ability in mathematics, and of course I always thought you were a good writer. But to bring those two together in a field that I hadn't really thought about, and I do remember you coming home from college as a sophomore and shyly saying you thought you had found your career. You thought you had found the subject you wanted to major in, and that it was a very small department, and you had no idea what you would do with this degree, but you wanted to be a linguist. And then you explained to me how you see language sometimes as math problems. Do you remember that?
You know, I don't remember that conversation, but I do remember my first linguistics class, and I fell in love with it on the first day, but it took me the whole semester to convince myself I could major in something that I perceived as impractical. In fact, it's not impractical, it's very practical, and not only for people like me who go on to actually work as linguists, but as a pre-law degree or in my field, computational linguistics, now people do a lot of work in industry, so it's very practical. But at the time, I didn't think so. And I remember part of what let me make that decision was how all my parents sent me to college saying, study whatever you want, we're sure you'll make something of it.
We were right, weren't we? I want to say that perhaps having a poet as a mom led you to feel that some things are impractical but worthwhile in the end. That said, you are a teacher now of many students who have to write academically, and I'm wondering how your experience, for instance, coming to many of my classes when I taught writing at the University of Washington to school-age kids, how your background in creative writing before you decided to become a linguist may be influencing the way you teach academic writing.
I think it influences quite a bit, actually. I work with a lot of students, especially those who come from computer science, who really don't like writing, and also a lot of students who feel like if they're writing academic writing, it should sound serious and difficult and obscure. And I think I draw on your lessons of show, don't tell, and that writing is about connection, to sort of insist on writing that is clear for the reader. So the writer is writing their truth, both the truth of what their science is finding, but also the truth of what they did to find those findings in their experiments or other studies, in a way that the reader can really gain access rather than trying to tell the reader this is important by using obscuring language.
I love that you learned that lesson. And now I want to ask you, what do they think when you kind of spin their head in a new direction with that idea?
Honestly, I don't get a lot of reaction directly to that idea. I get a lot of grumpiness about writing still. A presentation that I give to our master's students at the orientation called Writing in Grad School, and unfortunately, it's kind of buried in the middle of a 2-day orientation. And I think maybe they just feel a little bit like, okay, here's more stuff to worry about. But maybe they feel like, okay, this is not as hard as it seems, right? That I try to give practical advice, too, about dealing with writer's block. And one of the things that I tell them is it's okay to start writing in the middle of the paper, where a lot of people feel like they have to sit down and write it front to end. And maybe that's true for writing a story. I don't know. You can tell me if you can start a story in the middle.
I think you can.
You can?
Sure. Why not? You write what occurs to you, and a shape begins to unfold in creative writing. So sometimes when people try to start at the beginning, they find out that the real beginning of the story is in the middle. So it happens that way too. But I think that giving permission to sit down and write, which is what you're doing, is crucial. Otherwise, people do remain blocked. So
yeah.
What else do you tell them?
Well, so I tell them to make an outline to work out the structure, because with academic writing, you don't get to just find the structure. There's a pretty prescribed way it's supposed to go. But then once you've got the structure, it makes it really easy to say, okay, this is the part that looks like the most fun to write right now, or I know what I'm going to say here, so I'm going to say this. And especially for many people, save the introduction for last, because the introduction is meant to orient the reader to what all is coming. And if you haven't written the rest, it's really hard to do.
Absolutely. Even finding a title is sometimes really hard to do until you've written. So I like your advice. And do your students share their writing with other students?
Yes, to the extent that I can get them writing it early enough. So oftentimes for classes and for conferences, people are writing right up against the deadline. But I try to create a culture of getting people writing things earlier for a couple of reasons. One is to have a chance to share it with other people. And I have a seminar I'm teaching right now, and their drafts are due tomorrow. And then I've got the online system set up so that they're all going to get paired with someone else and then have to respond to those drafts.
Have you given them any guidance in how to respond?
I have, and that also draws very much on stuff I've learned from you. And let me just find exactly what I've said to them. I have them answering two questions about their partner's drafts. The first is, what did you learn from the paper? And I explain there, this will help the author understand what comes across clearly. And then, having read the paper, what do you wonder about? With the explanation, this can both be an indication of what isn't clear in the paper, as well as indication of where the project could go in the future. And this, to me, sounds like the sort of yes-and rule that I learned from you. Don't tell people this is wrong, but tell people, I don't understand here, or this makes me think.
Oh, good. It makes me very, very excited to learn how you're using what I was teaching and what I really believe in. It sounds like you really believe in it, too.
One time when using this advice of asking questions has backfired.
Okay.
So one of the things that I do with writing in my professional life is I review a lot of papers for conferences and journals. And I will often use that strategy of asking questions to indicate where I think more needs to be done. And when you review for a journal, there's this long back and forth process where the authors will then send responses to what the reviewers have said. And so there's one time where I asked a question and the authors sent me, I asked a question basically about one particular phrasing because I thought they had said something that was unsupported. And they sent me back a two-page long, very detailed explanation about why that was the right analysis encapsulated in those two words. I wrote back and I said, okay, obviously it's a very complicated matter. I think the best bet for this paper, since there's not room for this two pages of explanation, is to just take out one of those two words.
And is that what happened?
I think so. The final paper's not out yet, but I hope that's what happened.
Well, it'll be interesting for you to read it and find out if that's what happened. But sometimes that is exactly what happens. A writer's mind is moving on to something else when it isn't the focus, and it can be very confusing to the reader. So that's a fun example. Do you have some of your own academic writing you might share with us?
Yeah, I do. I have an example here of the introduction to a paper that I wrote. And this, I think, is a good illustration of what we were talking about briefly before, about how it's very structured writing and how one of the things I like to tell my students is we're not writing mystery novels, that the reader should be able to tell right up front what's coming in that paper and how they're going to get there, and then the rest of the paper fills it in. So I want to explain a couple words that I'm going to use first in the hopes of making this approachable. But this is from a paper that I co-authored with a colleague named Terry Langenden, and it appears in a journal called Linguistic Issues in Language Technology. And the title of the paper is Computational Linguistics in Support of Linguistic Theory. So what we're doing in this paper is arguing to our colleagues that even if they don't think of themselves as computational linguists, they should be learning how to use computational tools to do better linguistics. And we're talking in terms of a word that we got from the National Science Foundation called cyber infrastructure. And cyber infrastructure is basically the collection of computer hardware, computer software, and standards for encoding information that make a field better able to take advantage of computational methods. Does that make sense before I read the thing?
Yeah.
In our writing, we always have section headers. So this is section one, introduction. And it says, this paper seeks to answer two related questions. The first is, what can computers and the infrastructure in which they are networked together do for linguistics? And the second is, what do linguists need to know and do in order to take advantage of computational tools and resources in their work? We would like to emphasize at the outset that we are not advocating making all linguists into computational linguists. computational methodology for linguistic analysis is not the same thing as computational linguistics, though in many instances it relies on the results of previous work in computational linguistics, nor do we expect all linguists to become computer programmers. Rather, we are arguing that computers can be very effective tools in doing linguistic research, and the field as a whole will benefit to the extent that we can build on general advances in cyber infrastructure to create a cyber infrastructure for linguistics. As is probably clear from the tone, this paper aims to be explicitly persuasive. In particular, we aim to persuade the reader to try out current computational methodologies, to teach students to use computational methodologies, and to collaborate in building the next generation of infrastructure for computational methods in linguistics. This paper is structured as follows. Section 2 describes how computational methodologies can advance inquiry in linguistics in general terms and then through a series of examples of research questions which can only be approached with computer assistance, but which can be approached with existing or near-term technology. Section 3 surveys the currently existing infrastructure and sets the stage for Section 4, a pie-in-the-sky view of a linguistics research environment of the future. We aim there to dream big and then ask what needs to be done to get there. The first steps are described in Section 5.
Well, thank you.
So that's the whole introduction.
One of the things that occurs to me is when people are writing a nonfiction book, especially a book that is a how-to book, how to do something, how to use this book is often an introduction. And I think that it follows some of the same ideas. I'm very impressed with the idea that there is a first-person plural in there. You say we. I know that that engages me and makes me feel as if a real team of people is addressing me. When I was in school writing academic papers, we were not allowed to use first person anything. I'm happy to hear the first person because I always sat there wondering, if a person didn't write this to me, then who did? And
yeah.
I like knowing who these people are, you and your co-author.
That's actually something that I push for. A lot of people still feel like it sounds more scientific to avoid the first person. And I think that that's silly for the reasons you state, but also because science, though it strives to, it's a methodology for getting to objective truth, is always done by people who have their own perspective and their own point of view and their own lived experience, and to hide those people makes the science less reliable.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I know it makes it less engaging, but the fact that it also makes it less reliable is very interesting. In other words, we can't pretend to be totally objective. Is that what you're saying? Because
exactly.
We bring to any project our past experience and information.
And we should acknowledge it and own it rather than trying to hide it. And that's where the stronger reliability comes from. Before we leave the topic of we, I have to tell you one other thing about it, though, which is a field adjacent to mine, engineering, insists on using we even when it's a singly authored paper.
Hmm.
And that always strikes me as very strange. And I think it comes from a combination of the majority of the work done in engineering is actually done by groups of people, and so most of it is we. But then also people are taught to say we even if it's singly authored.
So that's
and I always push back.
Right. That's another way of hiding the I, and the royal we kind of thing can, I don't know about reading engineering papers, but I know the royal we can be kind of offensive at times because who is the royal we? What kind of power does the royal we have? Whereas an I is a person that you can identify with, agree with, or disagree with, but it isn't this big, massive royal we. Maybe that's what you're pushing back against. Although it is interesting. I mean, there's other language to admit that the author is presenting material that a team has built or that builds upon other people's work. That makes it more interesting to me to have that confessed up front than just merely sort of understood. So I'm glad you pushed back.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Sheila is speaking with University of Washington linguistics professor Emily Menon Bender about the influences of growing up with a poet mom.
I know that your work with the engineering part has a lot to do with artificial intelligence these days. Am I right?
Yeah.
And when I think of that, I think of how many occasions I've read articles that introduce the idea of computer-written poetry and compare it to human-written poetry and sometimes don't disclose which is which and ask the reader to decide. I have been right most of the time in identifying what a person wrote versus a computer, but I have to say it's getting harder. The more recent the articles, the more difficult it is to discriminate computer from person. And I'm wondering what you're thinking about computers as writers.
I can explain a little bit about why it's getting better. So all the things that you're reading recently are probably generated by statistical systems, statistical, or sometimes they call them neural nets, which is currently a very in vogue version of statistical processing that basically looks at large amounts of data and finds patterns in them and then can use those patterns to either classify new things, say that's a poem, that's not a poem, or generate and say, well, make a new poem. Okay, start from here, what comes out? And basically the math has gotten better at capturing fine details of the patterns, and the hardware has gotten better and the data sets have gotten bigger so that more data can be pushed in there.
Wow.
So where it's coming from.
So what that's saying to me is new poets better get edgier and break more patterns and yeah, step ahead of the computing programs.
The other thing about it is that the computer in lots of natural language processing technology, so that's the engineering field that I'm connected to, which is considered a part of artificial intelligence, in lots of it, the computer is working just with the form of language and not yet doing very much connecting the form to meaning. And so it can mimic the forms very well, and it can get a proxy for meaning by knowing things about which words tend to go together, but the computer has no idea what it's actually saying. And so I imagine that the more poems come from the heart and come from actual lived experience, the more you're going to get what's uniquely human in there.
Nice. I really love your phrase, a proxy for meaning. That sounds to me very lyrical and interesting and investigation worthy, both through science and poetry.
If you ever write a poem called A Proxy for Meaning, I would love to read it.
Well, I'll tell you, that's a challenge. I might just have to do that. I want to share it with a bunch of people. Wouldn't it be great to have a book, a collection called A Proxy for Meaning?
That would be lovely.
That would be fun. What else would you like to tell us about linguistics and writing?
So one topic that you and I like to talk about has to do with sociolinguistic variation in writing. So my kids now, as we said earlier, are 11 and 14, and they often say, oh, that wasn't grammatical, or so-and-so has bad grammar. And they're linguist kids, so they sort of say it with a twinkle in their eye, but I think it's really typical for kids in middle school and high school to be concerned about bad grammar. And it's a little bit worrisome because the notion of a standard language is very much tied up with norms and sort of gatekeeping around access to privilege in society. On the flip side of that is language variation. It's the natural state of languages to always be in variation and to have, as a part of the language, many different dialects that vary from each other. And usually what happens is that one dialect gets anointed the standard, and people who speak differently, because that's the language of their community or their home, are often stigmatized and looked down on. And so on the one hand, as a linguist, I want people to understand that all languages and all varieties of all languages are inherently systematic and as expressive as each other. But on the other hand, I have to say that we want kids to have access to privilege in society, basically, and having access to the anointed dialect is always probably going to be an important part of that. So the key issue is how can we celebrate variation while also making sure that everyone has access.
Do you have an answer?
Do I have an answer? So I think part of it is that whenever I get to talk to people about linguistics, that I want to put this piece of information out there that all dialects are systematic and there's no such thing as a language without rules. And then I think part of the answer lies in education. Instead of teaching kids that's bad grammar or that's wrong, to basically say, look, we can do some analysis. I want linguistics in the language arts classes, saying not here's what's right and here's what's wrong, but here's two systems and how they're different from each other.
I like that because what you're discussing with me, academic writing, has its rules. Mm-hmm. And you, I don't think, would include a dialect in your academic presentation unless it was what you were talking about. But in the one you read to us, you wrote it in standard academic, well, not that standard because you had the we in there, but academic language. And we expect that, right? So I like the idea of teaching that the language, the diversity in language doesn't mean it doesn't have rules. It means it's, I don't know if you would call it a different language or a dialect. What do you think?
So that's actually a really vexed question. You'd think that language and dialect, that a linguist would be able to define those, just like a linguist would be able to define what a word is. Uh-huh. But when you start looking into it, it gets really tricky. So it's probably best to think about languages as not discrete things, but as collections of dialects, and the dialects kind of merge into each other depending on how the languages have developed. So if you look at the Romance languages and you look at what was spoken before you had sort of standardized education across national boundaries, and you could basically walk from Paris to Rome, and from one village to the next, people could always talk to each other, and you would get from Parisian French to Roman Italian, where people can't understand each other.
Wow. So for a while during the walk, you would understand, and then suddenly you would no longer understand?
So if you were a Parisian French speaker, yeah, you would get to a point where you couldn't understand, but if you, from at each village, took someone with you to the next village, they would be able to understand each other.
So what do we call that then? Not dialect, but an accumulation of dialects to create a language?
It's complicated. We talk about language varieties. We talk about languages. And also talk about dialect continua, which is the situation I was just describing.
Ah, dialect continuum. And tell me about a word. You said linguists have trouble defining even a word.
If you look at a page of text and you want to count the words in it, there's a bunch of decisions you have to make. I'm looking at the two paragraphs that I just read to you, and in them, the decisions that I see that I would have to worry about are, I used the phrase pie in the sky, but I used it as a pre-modifier, right? A pie in the sky view, and so I've got hyphens in there. So is that one word? All right? Elsewhere in this paper, we may have used a contraction. This is something else that people say you're not supposed to do in academic writing, but I push back on that because I think that the intonation and the rhythm of language is really helpful for understanding it, and artificially expanding contractions breaks that rhythm, so I use them in my writing. And I figure, hey, I'm a linguist. I can say what's appropriate language.
I like it.
But what about doesn't? Is that one word? Is it two words?
What was the word?
The word doesn't.
Doesn't. Oh, the contraction. Yeah.
And then in other languages, so in English, we have conventions of using white space between the words. And so everyone has a really solid intuition that if we were going to put a space there, that's the boundary between words. But there's other languages that don't do that. Japanese doesn't, Chinese doesn't, Thai doesn't. German does, except that they squish all the compounds together. So does that mean those are each words? These really, really long strings of letters, where in English we would spell it with spaces in between?
Right. And tell me what's the impact of learning? Is it so computers can recognize language? Because I'm thinking as a writer, if I thought about all that stuff as I was writing, I would stop writing. So if we're used to our language and we just use it, we're not thinking that way. So why are linguists worrying about that?
Why are linguists worrying about that? Not for our writing. For linguists, we need to have a sense of what the units are of sentences because we're interested in how those units fit together to build up a sentence, what makes a sentence grammatical according to the system of the dialect or language, and also how those pieces combine to make the meaning of the sentence.
That's the part I like, to make the meaning of the sentence.
Right.
So I think that I'd love to have some time for you to read a little bit more from one of your writings before we end today. So do you have something else selected?
I do. I have a really fun thing that was a different kind of writing than I usually have to do. It's part of a grant application I put in with a colleague named Gina Ann Laveau. And this was not a grant to a federal agency like we usually apply for. This was to Amazon that has a program called Catalyst. And so their application was very unusual, and they asked us to write a hypothetical press release. And they say, leap into the future and imagine that your project has launched. Now write the press release to tell the world about it. And so the idea was to show where we planned to be at the end of the project by writing this press release. So I usually write nonfiction, but this was maybe speculative fiction or speculative nonfiction. And so this is about documenting endangered languages, and I think that part's pretty self-explanatory, but I want to tell just ahead of time that in writing this press release, because we were talking about endangered language communities, we felt like we couldn't use the real name of anything because we don't know who we would interview. So you'll see there's some made-up names of people and institutions. So the press release dateline, Seattle, Washington, September 15th, 2018. Researchers from the University of Washington today unveiled new automatic speech processing systems to help communities revitalizing endangered languages and linguists who work in language documentation. These systems automatically identify the speakers, languages, and content in recordings of critically endangered languages. They were the winners of the first streamlined challenge, where researchers compete to build the best systems to help save endangered languages. The researchers have advanced the state-of-the-art in speaker and language identification while aiding efforts to preserve and reinvigorate languages at risk of disappearing from the world. speech-based technology like Amazon Alexa is becoming part of everyday experience for speakers of English and a few other languages, Chinese, Spanish. These languages, though widely spoken, only cover 25% of the world's population. The new speech systems created in the Streamline Challenge are a first step to bringing such technology to the world's 3,000-plus endangered languages and letting speakers of those languages enter the digital age on their own terms. Speakers of endangered languages will be able to access recordings and oral histories to revitalize their languages and re-engage with these repositories of their culture and history. Endangered language researchers will be able to double the throughput of their preservation work while focusing on deeper insights into language structure. Maintainers of speech repositories can now offer sophisticated search and browsing over their enriched audio content. The capabilities afforded by the Streamline tools are particularly crucial now. Of the world's 7,000 languages, nearly half are expected to disappear by 2100. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit here. The winning systems are already widely deployed. Jane Smith of the Native Nation has been digitizing anthropologists' recordings of her grandmother and others telling stories archived in the UW libraries. With the reel-to-reel tapes digitized, Jane is now using the Streamline tools to help overcome the daunting challenge of finding the stories by her grandmother. Meanwhile, Big Language Archive is running the software over their entire collection, consisting of 2,000 hours of recordings from 50 languages spoken in the Americas, to improve the collection's metadata and make it easier for researchers and community members to discover relevant recordings. Such rapid transfer from research to deployment is remarkable in speech technology, especially for academic research. Pat Jones, a student at Big State U and co-developer of the winning system, says, "I'm thrilled to see my work already in the hands of real users working to revitalize and document languages."
Thank you, Emily. You know what? I'm thinking as I listen to this, what a fabulous prologue to a mystery thriller. What happens if somebody steals this research or gets their hands on some of the equipment or even a undocumented language becomes more prevalent? So many possibilities. I like this Amazon idea of writing your press release for a proposed project. And it was very interesting to think that Chinese, would you say Chinese, Spanish, and English only represent 25% of the world's languages?
Yeah, and actually I'd have to double check to see if that number included a few other big languages. We were under a very strict word count here, but I think 25% is about right for the number of people in the world who speak one of the big languages as their native language.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today and for sharing your linguistic background and projects with a wider audience outside of academia. I want to remind people that you can find out more about Emily through her bio at the University of Washington's faculty listings online. And again, thank you so much, Emily. It was really a pleasure to speak with you in this way.
You're welcome. This has been a lot of fun.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.